So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review, man.
Well, we know that only one Undertaker's going to walk out of here.
Yes, indeed.
Doesn't look like it's going to be him, does it?
Not at the moment. And no! Missing with the elbow. And a clothesline. The Undertaker with a chop.
On the Undertaker.
And a headbutt. You can hear the virtual silence of this capacity crowd. They're stunned.
Oh.
And we had no idea exactly what we were going to see. It's very eerie.
Well, now it's Paul Bearer's Undertaker who's stunned.
Welcome to Review Away. I am John Pollock, and I'm with Wei Ting, the single Wei Ting.
I'm not getting married.
That's great to hear. I'm very happy.
I'm not even getting married anymore.
Well, that can also be good.
Fine.
That's great. Fine. How are you?
Good. Yeah.
It's been good, man. It's been a while since we've done a show in person together.
That is right. Last week, of course, we had holidays up here in Canada.
The week before you were gone?
I say up here in Canada, but we could very well have listeners in the Arctic.
Yep. Down here in Canada.
Down here.
Maybe east here in Canada, west in Canada, here in Canada.
Maybe right here, right in between us. In that case, it'd be right in between, right?
Right in the thick of things.
Yeah, right in you.
If we had a giant elephant here in this room.
Okay.
How have you been?
Fine. Yeah, I've been good.
It's great.
What am I supposed to say? Spectacular?
Yeah, I'm just opening the door for you to walk in and then.
I'm not even criticizing your question. It's a very good question that you're asking. I just mean like.
Great question.
When people are answering that question, I mean, I don't feel right. I feel wrong to say just okay, because if I say just okay, people automatically assume that there's something that's not great. So, why is your life not perfect? Shouldn't your life be perfect all the time? What is missing from it that'll make it perfect? But I don't feel right saying that it's perfect either, or that it's even great. We're just kind of like...
I don't think the person asking the question wants to hear your life is perfect either. It almost puts pressure on them, like, why is my life not perfect? This person's is.
Maybe, perhaps. I just mean, I don't know. That question kind of puts me in an uncomfortable situation.
How are you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I don't know how to answer that.
What could you be doing better, sir?
See, that's exactly what that question sounds like. How are you? That's, you know, how could your life be better?
What kind of a coffee do you have here?
I have a small Tim Hortons coffee with a lactose-free skim milk. Or lactose-free milk. It's not skim.
Oh.
Yeah.
Did you get into a conversation with the guy taking your order?
No.
No? Because I also went to Tim Hortons. We missed each other. And he needed a minute to make my coffee. So he decided to start talking to me. I had my headphones on. I was like, oh, Christ. He's like, so how's your day, sir? Shit, I wish I had your answer. To come back at him and said, I don't feel comfortable with that question. I said, it's great. It's great. He's like, how is your Monday?
What, you You said it's great, and he kept pressing.
Yeah.
Around. The nerve of this man.
I was just, hey, it's not, whatever. It's fine. It's fine. But I mean.
What an asshole.
At the root of it, I know you don't care about my day. You just are hoping that I can just wait a little longer as you make my coffee, and you want to keep me entertained. But you know what? I got entertainment in my ears here, so whatever. He's like, how's your Monday going? Like, it's just another Monday. Bet you wish it was the weekend. No, I'm fine with Monday. You know, I'm not counting down life to just get to some mythical day of the week that is going to represent more happiness than what this is. I don't mind Mondays. Mondays are fine.
Well, I don't like Mondays, so I can relate to his questioning. But
why don't you like Mondays? Is it just it's the beginning of a work week? Is it just it's a?
Because I like to sleep in.
Oh,
John, I like to not have to wake up, and I do on Mondays.
Well, that's life.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's unfortunate. The fact that this man tried to initiate
calls. No, not unfortunate. Unnecessary.
Are there ever any times, though, throughout your day that you wish somebody would talk to you? That you kind of want human interaction?
You make me sound like such a hermit. I welcome human interaction. Just, I need something to it.
You need there to be a reason.
Yes.
Yeah.
I interact with you. I know I bother you because I will randomly, that many times, way more than vice versa, I'll be bored and I will wander over to your room just to say hello. But I always come with a point. I always have something to tell you.
I don't care if you don't have a point. You can just.
I always feel you're going to call me on and be like, why are you here?
No.
And I got to be ready. I got to be ready for waiting.
Don't be ridiculous.
You never come to say hello to me.
I don't go to anybody's room. I feel uncomfortable doing that just in general. I'm like you. Like, I feel like I need a reason to sit down. But I'm also like, I just feel uncomfortable in other people's space.
Yeah?
That's just me. I'm fucked up.
Like that. You're not fucked up.
But I don't feel right to like step over and just like small talk. But I welcome it. I mean, I quite enjoy it. So come and just sit down.
Today, you and I, we watched some videos online together. We watched some Minoru Suzuki.
Oh, great video. I ended up watching the whole thing.
You watched the whole thing?
Yeah.
26 minutes of it.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, tell us about the video for those that are not familiar. I will post this in an update.
It was WH who brought this to your attention.
Yes.
It's, I guess, New Japan. They make these trading cards. It's like a – they're just trading cards. And they came – somebody
– this was a brilliant idea to promote it.
Yeah. Somebody within New Japan came up with a brilliant idea of filming their stars opening packets of trading cards and basically kind of getting their commentary as they go through the process. And I mean, I think it would be one thing if it was like just a guy going through card – like going through cards that are presented to him. But they actually let somebody like Minoru Suzuki take the box – have to physically cut open the plastic from
with
the
scissors.
Box. Yeah, have to figure out how to do that. Then have to figure out how to open up the box and then physically open every packet one by one. And I don't know why, but I found it incredibly entertaining to hear somebody like Minoru Suzuki say, "When I cut the packet, I try to cut it so that it doesn't cut all the way. That way, you have less trash." It's brilliant.
Or when he has the box and he's like, it won't open, goddammit.
Yeah. So it's great, and especially like Minoru Suzuki. And first of all, we have
there's less trash.
Yeah, we have to thank the guy, the fan who decided to subtitle all this in English, because one of the best subtitling jobs I have ever seen in any type of
this
thing.
Is tremendous.
Not only does he, you know, obviously does a great job of translating it, but he'll put little footnotes to let let a North American audience viewer know that the references that they make that you might not understand. So
like he brings up this Korean pop band,
yeah.
And then in the notes above it explains this is a Korean band, yeah. So you understand the context of what he's saying here and making sure you know this is an insult.
Yeah, and Minoru Suzuki's in particular was great just because he knows a lot of these guys, obviously, and not only that, but like he adds a bit of drama to it. Like he'll like peek out the card from the packet, like, just a little bit and be like, uh-oh, well, I see the frosted tips. It's got to be Taka Michinoku or something like that, you know? Like,
does a Seiji Sakaguchi impression.
Yeah. So many things that I don't even get, but, like, it's just amusing to see this kind of, like, stoic, tough guy pro wrestler open up little packets of trading cards. Like a,
yeah, like, to get it across, Minoru Suzuki is, like, the grizzled veteran shooter who pretty much plays this bully in his matches, the shooter bully. So he's just this hard ass. I think, you know, very somewhat similar, I would say, to how Brock Lesnar is presented, somewhat. But I would say
Brock would never
a different kind of charisma than Brock Lesnar.
I imagine, like, Minoru Suzuki is very much aware of the character. I mean, and Brock is too, but I don't see Brock Lesnar opening up packs of trading cards and giving it nearly as entertaining of a commentary track.
But I could totally see Brock opening these cards and just burying guys on the roster. Like, look at the Carl Anderson. Yeah. I am not interested in this guy.
And, like, such a simply cheaply produced thing that's just, I thought.
Yeah, two cameras. They had one on him and one over his shoulder, and they just had a picture in picture.
Great content. And, you know, as far as, like, thinking about how this might apply to a North American thing, like the WWE, how many products do they have? Why not have some of your talent play the video game and at least, you know, talk about it, or even, like, even if they suck at it, it's part of the fun. You get to see them have fun doing it. After this, I wanted to buy some cards.
I am very much looking forward to watching the rest of this video now that I know it's there's two parts to it.
There are a number of them, I believe. Suzuki's only done one, but, like, they've done them with, like, you know, Nakamura. They've done them with
That would be awesome, with Nakamura.
It wasn't as good.
Oh, you've watched some? Jesus, you just went down the rabbit hole here.
Yeah, it was really entertaining. I really liked it. But,
I don't know how you found all this time, because when I came over, you still had, like, an hour of SummerSlam to watch.
I crammed.
Man.
I did.
Well, this is it's a great pair of videos. Series.
We'll do a review away on these videos.
Okay, I'm going to watch them all this week.
I'm joking.
There's no way we can
review man opening up trading cards. That might be.
Wait, we have reviewed porn live. We can do anything.
That's true.
We do. I did want to ask you. We're coming up to our 5-year anniversary show, and I have absolutely no idea what to review.
Dude, I don't know either. Maybe.
I want to kind of throw it out to the people.
Yeah, I do too.
I don't really want to review porn. Unless someone makes a compelling argument for something, I won't close the door on anything.
I
will not order anything ever again.
I have no interest, obviously, watching a Buff Bagwell porn, because I know a lot of people were
well, it doesn't exist that. Yet, so it won't be out in a month.
So I just want to throw that out there, please.
You don't want to see the Blockbuster?
Really.
Do you know what his wife's name is?
Judy.
Judy Bagwell.
You told me this.
Oh, very weird. Well, maybe that's a 6-year anniversary review. But why not we open it up to the people? We have a month. Yeah. And I want to know what you guys want us to review, because I want it to be something special, something important. And I think you people should be creative. Come up with something. I don't want to hear, like, Unforgiven 2003 as our review. Something.
What would you click on if you saw? Oh shit! They're reviewing this. I gotta put my headphones on in the middle of this shower and listen.
That's the litmus test. What you would be willing to electrocute yourself to listen to?
Yeah,
that is the question. We're going to be getting into SummerSlam. Have you been following any of the Rob Ford bomb threats?
No, what's the latest?
There was a bomb threat sent to him on Monday to his brother, a poorly spelt out warning letter with all these spelling mistakes, and Rob Ford decided to read it to the media, and the person was saying that you and your brother are to leave office and the bomb is already set up. City Hall will be no more if you remain.
Okay.
The spelling, though, kind of took the edge off of it, that this guy is really serious.
Wait a second. What do you mean? Like, what did he spell wrong?
Many words within this warning.
So it came across like he was somebody who's not very educated? Or
that would certainly be the case.
Or maybe he was typing on his phone.
It was on a piece of paper. It was typed out.
Yeah, you could email somebody on the phone.
I guess that could have been done.
So, but I don't know why that would kind of relieve any type of tension. In fact, it would make me even more
nervous. I would say if you can't spell a letter, I would doubt you could actually bypass security at City Hall and set up a bomb.
Okay, not to be even, like, not to, this is going to sound even controversial, even me suggesting this, but it could be somebody who's maybe not very familiar with the English language that's calling in this bomb threat.
It could.
I'm just saying that that might be one of the explanations for the poor spelling. You know?
I wonder if we can find the picture of it where you can see the...
But, I mean, bomb threats are nothing to be laughed at.
They aren't, but I would imagine in politics, how many threats go completely unannounced on a yearly basis in any major city out there?
I suppose for like my kind of like twisted pro wrestling influenced mindset, I look at any type of these stories and I wonder how...
Oh, it was an email.
Okay, yeah, there you go. So, and I wonder like how it'll affect his campaign. You know, I wonder if there's any like ulterior motive even to reading this out in public as opposed to keeping it private. Do you think this will create some sympathy?
Perhaps? Well, Rob Ford said he was acting upon his own recommendations to read this and make it public. So I don't know. I don't know what the thought process is there. It could be maybe create sympathy. Look, people are trying to kill me. This is outrageous.
Mm. Vote for me. September such and such.
What October.
October, yeah.
Yes. It's a big election coming up here in Toronto, which...
Maybe that'll be the review.
The election?
Yeah. No, we won't hit it.
You know what I really enjoyed was when...
Man, the anniversary is coming up in like a month.
Oh, I know. Wow. That's why I'm bringing it up now. But when I interviewed Paul Heyman, one of the things I enjoyed the most was how he incorporated these Toronto-centric references. He worked in Rob Ford into the interview when bringing up a hypothetical arena. He brought up the Rogers Centre.
Yes, yes.
That's a pro right there.
Yeah,
I'm sure he knows who's interviewing him, what city are they in, and customizing it for that market.
He should have said the Hershey Center. Wouldn't that have
been cool? I guess that would be an ode to ECW's one and only adventure to Mississauga, Ontario.
Yeah.
Still a show I wish I went to.
Yeah, yeah, me too, man.
In 2000, and it was a Saturday, I believe. I had to work that day.
Wow. You remember that specific? Okay. Anyway, yeah, that'd be great. But yeah, I'm personally surprised because living in Toronto, you don't really understand kind of the scope of these stories and how far they reach. But like I was in New York last week and I met people who were asking us about Rob Ford simply because it was the only reference to Toronto they had, you know, that they could have brought up. So he's a big deal. He's certainly more popular than our prime minister or any other political figure in our country.
Yeah. I also recently interviewed Ken Shamrock, where I brought up, somehow Rob Ford came up, and I asked Ken Shamrock, "Are you aware of Rob Ford?" And he said, "Oh yeah, absolutely." And that's one thing that, you know, he was like complimenting just political leaders and how everyone should be respecting them, and he just gave this kind of answer where at the end of it, I was like, he has no idea who Rob Ford is.
Really?
Based on the answer, I think he just assumed, yeah, he's obviously the mayor, but I could have said, oh, are you aware of the mayor of Wyoming? Yes, yes, you always have to respect those leaders that lead particular cities.
Why would you lie about that? Like, what does he have to lose by saying, I don't know who Rob Ford is?
I think he was just expecting oh, of course I know your mayor.
You should have, like, made some name up.
Yeah.
Like, do you know Dan Lavransky?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Deputy mayor.
Yeah.
Dan Lavransky. Well, are you aware of SummerSlam 94?
I am aware.
This was a strange show. This was from August the 29th of 1994, a Monday night pay-per-view. Could you imagine watching pay-per-views on Monday nights?
Yeah, and why was that? Why did they do Monday?
I have a feeling it was simply because they had done it the year... SummerSlams used to be on Monday nights, as I recall.
Really?
For a few years they ran as. I think from 91 through 94, they ran them on Monday nights, I believe. And I don't know if that was simply because that night Raw was going to be preempted because of the U.S. Open, and they wanted, hey, the audience is used to Monday nights,
right.
Let's put it on... The Monday night. It was they never did that for any other pay-per-views. It was just typically those Survivor Series used to be on Wednesday nights.
Hmm.
It used to be Thanksgiving Eve. That's how they would promote it.
Interesting.
Before everything got moved to Sunday nights. But this was, I remember so Well, when I was watching Superstars, and they would go to the event center, and it was always a big deal when they would announce the main event for the upcoming pay-per-view, because we had this big gap between pay-per-views at the time, and they announced The Undertaker versus The Undertaker. And I thought, that sounds stupid. That sounds ridiculous. And I think 10-year-old me completely vindicated 20 years later that it was stupid then, stupid now, and perplexing. This is the main event of SummerSlam. Okay.
But even as a 10-year-old, was there no part of you that bought into this storyline that thought it was, you know, cool that you're all of a sudden you're seeing two Undertakers? The fact that they're even able to pull off one guy who looks exactly like another guy together in the same ring. Didn't you think that was cool?
I don't recall being excited in any way. For the two of them. I mean, watching this, I mean, they did a hell of a job dressing up Brian Lee.
Totally. Yeah.
Like, right down to the tattoos.
Yes.
I will give them complete credit for going all the way with this. But you cannot look at this experiment as a successful one.
When you're a 10-year-old, were you able to tell that this was not the real Undertaker?
I mean, the thing was, you barely saw him because, remember, we didn't see Monday Night Raw, so it was really limited to highlights. I can't remember what I was thinking.
Well, he walked out and stuff, you know.
On Raw, he did. Yeah. I'm just saying, if I had seen any of the clips of this guy, it would have been briefly on Superstars while they were recapping Raw.
I think I remember kind of like not being sure because I never really watched that closely, and they were able to like hide his face very well with the hair. Like, great job, like you said, you know, with the makeup, with the costume, with the haircut even, to make this guy very believably look like The Undertaker.
And they sent him out on the road. I mean, all those appearances leading up to SummerSlam, and he did house shows, that was always Brian Lee during that time, as Mark Calloway had been given time off for that entire year from that write-off at the Royal Rumble where he was murdered. Destroyed in a casket match, and then he exploded on the screen. And this was him, all his particles coming back together over the next 8 months. So this was from the actual name of the arena, according to Vince McMahon, all night long was the brand new United Center. Never once just said it without the words brand new attached to it, where the Chicago Bulls play in Chicago.
Blackhawks.
And the Blackhawks play, yes. The show starts off with Randy Savage coming out as our host for what I would venture to guess was the easiest night of work in Randy Savage's entire career. This consisted of three takes and about three sentences as host of SummerSlam.
I would have to think he probably had easier times making money in WCW, where he probably didn't even come to work and made more money.
I would say in terms of times of being physically at an arena, this would probably be at the top of them.
Yeah.
And this really, you know, when you hear the stories that Randy Savage still felt he could go in the ring and the WWF didn't see him at that spot, I'm sure this particular night at one of your biggest shows of the year, and this was his role, Randy Savage felt like this was completely unnecessary. Like, let this guy go if you don't see anything in him. Because he was probably making a good downside even as a non-wrestler at this point. But this was a waste.
I thought at the very least they put him on commentary. And to be honest with you,
I was not upset about that.
Yeah, like, well, after watching last week's two Raws, I'm not upset about that either. But it was a weird start to the show in that they basically had him come out. All he did was just come out to address the home audience. He wasn't even on the house mic. And then he hands the duties off to McMahon and Lawler while he continues to pose in the ring, leaving Lawler and McMahon in the complete darkness of the arena to introduce the show to the audience.
Yes, he refers to Vince McMahon as a friend of mine. I want to say Vince McMahon and Jerry Lawler, I thought they were a great team together. And one of the key things, some of these matches, they did such a great job of telling the stories of the important matches. And I think these two, one of the more underrated combinations of WWF broadcasters, especially Lawler on this show. Yeah. And Vince, I mean, he knew where the direction was going for all of this stuff. So he was really key in that play-by-play role all those years. But I thought the announcing was a complete 180 from the Raws we reviewed a week ago.
I think Vince is like, very good at like kind of maybe getting you excited and talking about storylines. But obviously his shortcomings are with the actual calling of the matches themselves and the moves and all that.
Yes, which at this time the in-ring product had not outgrown Vince to the degree it would years later when you were seeing more and more innovations. This was still a fairly safe kind of in-ring product to call for a Vince McMahon type.
But I agree with you about Lawler. Like, this is the Jerry Lawler that I think is the best kind of announcer, you know, that he's done. Like, you know, we've talked about in recent years how he's kind of regressed to, like, this uncle, creepy uncle, you know?
Who stares down Paige.
Yeah, and is not even, like, just not all that interesting. But here, he fulfills the role of the heel, you know, talking for the heels, and he's entertaining as shit.
And really, you know, this Jerry Lawler, I mean, he will freely admit, he comes to Raw, he does little prep, calls the show, he's very comfortable in that role, and then he goes home, and there is no wrestling for the next week. He is not up on SmackDown, he is not in depth of what is happening. It's just he's got his routine down. He has that ability to go on for 3 hours and he's fine. But
you know what?
A far cry from this Jerry Lawler.
Yeah, like it really comes across the fact that he doesn't really care. You know what I mean? Like it really kind of does just feels like he's here to make money. And no doubt he's probably here to make money even back then. But it just felt like he was a lot more into the product at this time.
They were also really pushing this idea of the new generation at this point. And this was, of course, this summer was a very big one with the steroid trial just ending. And also, Hulk Hogan had just debuted for WCW the month prior. So you were starting to see the first time WCW was really representing a kind of a threat since, you know, the mid-80s when they were very competitive with the WWF, but at this point, WCW had really been entrenched in that number two spot in North America, or at least in the U.S., and now with Hogan going there, you certainly saw that WCW was starting to get some muscle behind them and had just done a really successful pay-per-view with Hogan and Ric Flair in their debut. So you were starting to see the WWF's reaction to that. Lawler announces that the night prior at a house show in Indianapolis, Indiana, Diesel and Shawn Michaels won the tag titles from the Head Shrinkers, and they also announced that the British Bulldog and his arms are here.
The British Bulldog and his arms are here.
Yes.
Okay. Cool.
Which he had to get scanned at the airport separately. He was, my goodness.
He's a big man.
He was a large man, and
his frame was as long as his hair was.
Yes, someone that was maybe not following the steroid trial too closely, or maybe very closely.
Who knows?
Allegedly. IRS and Bam Bam Bigelow started off the show teaming together with Ted DiBiase, who would be all over this show, taking on the Head Shrinkers, accompanied by Captain Lou Albano and Offa.
So did we see them on Raw last week?
Who was that? The Head Shrinkers?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. I'm trying to think if so they lost the titles
at the house show
a few days ago.
Yeah,
and okay, it was obviously a lot more common back then to have house show title changes.
It happened every now and then, not in a gigantic amount of regularity, but for whatever reason, I guess they wanted to get the titles onto Diesel and Michaels, and you know you didn't have all these major shows to do switches at, and you know every now and then do something on the house shows. Vince announces, they look ready to shrink some heads tonight. The Head Shrinkers, in fine form. There was a standing enziguri from Bigelow to
the
Fatu.
Shrinkers. I just, like, I guess...
They shrunk heads.
You don't realize how politically incorrect certain things from your childhood are until you kind of see them again, like, 20 years later.
Oh, yeah.
The Head Shrinkers.
These guys who, shots to the head don't hurt.
Yeah.
Because they're barely human. They're Samoans.
They're voodoo.
Yeah. Bigelow misses a headbutt off the top. Samu comes in. They hit a double super kick to Bigelow. Offa is speaking Samoan, and Vince translates it to Offa saying, Domino's delivers. That's what Offa was trying to say, according to Vince, the translator. Okay. IRS comes in, dives at Samu, goes over the top to the floor. Back in the ring, Bulldog then pulls down the top rope. Samu goes to the floor, and he gets run into IRS's briefcase. Samu hits a headbutt to IRS. Off the second turnbuckle, Bigelow makes the save. They double-team IRS. Fatu comes off the top with a splash, but then Ted DiBiase distracts the referee. Bigelow attacks Samu on the floor and attacks Fatu. And then Lou Albano is knocked off the apron. Offa runs in and attacks Bam Bam Bigelow for the DQ at 7:21 to end the match. And then the head shrinkers take out Bigelow, and Offa, Samu, and Fatu all headbutt Bigelow, and DiBiase runs to the back as all four of the teammates fight in the aisle.
Yeah.
Great DQ finish. That was a pretty lame match to begin with.
Well, I don't even know if they really announced the match before this, did they? Wasn't this sort of an impromptu match?
I'm not quite sure. They sure didn't mention it on the Raw going into
it. But clearly they didn't see it important enough to give away the finish.
I don't even know why this was on the show or why we couldn't at least get a clean finish on a show.
Yeah.
Had to extend this great tag program.
I will say they got pretty good heat by the end. The crowd was totally... I mean, the crowds like back then are just... They're a really good period, you know, and especially on a show like this.
No, up until a match.
Yeah, that's true.
One particular match.
You know, watching this, I always remember the head shrinkers as heels. I don't really remember them as like baby faces. And you know, you can't help but you know make the obvious comparisons between them and Rikishi's kids in the Usos at this moment in terms of both in ring style and sort of their appeal to an audience as baby faces who don't really talk.
Maybe that was what was holding the Usos back all those years. They weren't...
Shrinking heads.
Yeah, they weren't shrinking heads.
Clearly, yes.
They'd have to be a more politically correct version, like the therapists. The shrinks.
The therapists, okay.
Leslie Nielsen is backstage with detective music and follows a sign that says Undertaker Trail because he's on the trail.
Did you ever watch the Naked Gun movies?
No.
No, me neither. So, I mean, a lot of these jokes just kind of, like, flew over my head.
I would assume even the most ardent Naked Gun fans were probably left wanting from these skits. He gets stopped by security, who then eventually give him a pass, thinking he's Lloyd Bridges. And then he goes up to someone dressed in The Undertaker, but it's revealed to be his Naked Gun castmate and a featured prominent actor from the series Dallas during their late run, George Kennedy, who is undercover, and now both are on the case. And then we see a sign that says Undertaker Trail pointing in both directions.
They were on the case literally. Like they panned the camera down and the two of them were standing on a case.
Which, my God, would they love that play on words for later on in the show.
Once is fine. Twice within the same program? Maybe a little much.
But we needed the payoff to this long search. Like, what a stupid idea all these skits were.
Yeah.
Like,
well, I mean, especially for something as serious as, I don't know, the Undertaker character that they seem to want to, you know, treat it as. Or maybe they didn't. Maybe it was all slapstick to them.
This was so campy. It was just, God, horrible creative. Gorilla Monsoon is on the SummerSlam hotline with the British Bulldog and his arms, interviewing all three of them. And then we heard some Asian music play from the WWF's International Library of Music, the Jim Johnston compilation. Of course, Japanese music. Out comes Bull Nakano.
Yeah, the best part of it was like, you know how the entrance, they kind of like have lights and sometimes they like to throw little silhouettes of like the logos and all that?
Yes.
So in this case, they had like some kanji. I can't read it, but it was, I assume it was like Bull Nakano's name or something. They shot some kanji from like the inside of it in a silhouette, but the characters are backwards, so they came out like essentially looking like gibberish because it's flipped, and I doubt anybody noticed.
I did not, but I'm glad you had a keen eye for that. Mm-hmm. This is our second review involving Bull Nakano in 3 weeks. You missed Collision in Korea, where she was on that card.
Yes, right, of course.
So a lot of Bull Nakano this month, and that's not a bad thing. Luna Vachon was in Nakano's corner challenging Alundra Blaze for the women's title. They mentioned that they had a double countout prior to this. Each of the women were given flowers to start the match.
Japanese tradition.
Yes, and then Luna throws Bull's flowers at Blaze. Some fan in the audience spent a lot of time creating the sign that read, "Bull will Blaze."
Well, who's he actually supporting?
Bull Nakano's marijuana? I don't know. Bull will Blaze.
Bull will Blaze. Like, that to me suggests that he could be supporting either woman.
Yeah, like, if you're going down in a blaze of glory, or down in a blaze, I'm saying it could be positive to either of them.
Yeah.
Bull will Blaze. Will she fall in a blaze?
Will she blaze through
Will she blaze? Blow through Blaze?
Unclear.
God, a very ineffective sign. Needs clarification on the other side of the Bristol board. Blaze misses with a drop kick and gets thrown by the hair by Bull, who has the advantage, hits a leg drop for a two count. USA chant begins from the intolerant Chicago fans. Bull is beating down Blaze. She comes back with a Hurricane Rana, a spinning kick. Then Nakano with a one-handed Boston Crab is applied, but Blaze makes it to the rope. Then Nakano applies the Scorpion Cross, which is the submission she made very famous that Paige will credit as adopting from.
Right.
And then she lets go of it. Luna starts attacking Alundra behind the referee's back. Nakano goes for an armbar, which was hilarious because zero reaction to this as any kind of a submission maneuver or anything that could end a match. Blaze makes it back to her feet, hits three sling blades. So while Paige was watching her Nakano matches, Hiroshi Tanahashi watching his Alundra Blaze matches in 1994.
Definitely.
There's a backslide out of the corner for a two by Blaze. Nakano then counters a Hurricane Rana with a powerbomb for a two count, scoop slams Blaze, and then goes to the top, misses a leg drop, which was a staple for this woman. And you hear Hulk Hogan talk about the worst idea he ever had was making his finish a leg drop. God only knows what Bull Nakano did to her spine doing this off the top rope. Mm-hmm. And thank God Fandango has quietly retired that from his arsenal as well.
Yeah.
Blaze then kicks Luna off the apron and hits a bridging German for the pin at 8 minutes and 19 seconds. A very good match. I will go so far as to say second best match on the show.
Yes, I completely agree. I totally forgot that these two had such great matches during their little run. I think everybody, you know, when they talk about women's wrestling in the WWE, they obviously cite the Trish Lita era. But I think, you know, this little series that these two had is often forgotten to have taken place during the 90s within the WWE. So, really good match. To me, it was just cool to see Bull Nakano in the WWE because she's so different from anything that we've seen in North America. Just even down to the look, that tall blue hair.
Amazing
zombie makeup and that weird coat that, like, who knows what her influences were in designing these things. But great wrestling, obviously, as well. You know, from both Nakano and Alundra Blaze, who I thought did a tremendous job selling throughout. And really good technical wrestling that I don't think really gets brought up at all anymore.
Yeah, this was a very, very solid match. And I was such a big – this was the first time when I was a kid I had ever seen Bull Nakano. And the look just – I was such a big fan. The first time I just saw her, just based on the look.
Did you try to rock the hairstyle?
I tried. I could only get about 3 inches, though, at that time. Todd Pettengill is with Diesel and Shawn Michaels backstage. They have their tag titles. And Shawn announces, "Presto Changeo, we wanted more gold, so we won the tag titles." And says, "They are the two most happening cats in the WWF. Diesel says he should be called Midas because everything he touches turns to gold." And then he says, in reference to Razor Ramon winning the title tonight, "It ain't gonna happen tonight. What makes you think it will happen tonight?" And then he leans back and yells, "It's going to happen."
Bad guy, you've had a lot of chances and you haven't come through yet. What makes you think it's going to happen tonight?
Folks, we
ain't
may
gonna
be
gonna happen.
So he contradicts himself and calls the title change. And Michael says they overlook everyone and calls Walter Payton a munchkin.
It was a very different promo style from Kevin Nash at this stage of his career. he almost seemed to cut these Diesel, early Diesel promos with like a New York accent, you know? From, I don't know why, but he would say things like, "It don't get no better than this." You know, it's very different from how we hear him speak these days, or at least even later on in his career, where he basically sounds like he's half asleep most of the time when he's talking. And that's coming from me, someone who also talks like that. So, I don't know. The guy kind of
maybe
like
you
it.
Gotta incorporate a little New York into your delivery.
Yo, it this review don't get no better than this. Is that New York?
That's distinctly Scarborough. So Diesel with Shawn Michaels against Razor Ramon with Walter Payton. I talked about this before, but I mean, at this point in time, it's not like the WWF was overflowing with great talent in terms of in-ring. So, I mean, you were really putting storyline first here and in-ring second by having Shawn Michaels simply be who I thought was the best worker in this match, just as the guy in Diesel's corner. But I thought the show really suffered from not having a Shawn Michaels match, not having maybe even a Sean Waltman in like an opener or something.
But with that said, I thought this match far exceeded my expectations.
Absolutely. If you were to watch this on mute, this was nothing special, but they worked this match so well that they had the crowd and it told a very good story. There was a big reaction for the announcement when they said it was now time for the Intercontinental title match. Walter Payton coming out with Razor Ramon. McMahon proclaims this will be a, quote, humdinger. Humdinger time.
Okay.
Ramon instantly sends Diesel to the floor. He returns and beats down Ramon, attacking his lower back. Lawler plugs the fact that Diesel and Michaels were on Regis and Kathy Lee that morning. And then Diesel sends Ramon over the top to the floor. Michaels then, I guess Toru Yano may be watching as Shawn Michaels, as Michaels took the turnbuckle padding off behind the referee's back. The crowd gets into Payton standing up to Michaels as Michaels backs off and then runs away and then runs onto the steps and over, clotheslining Razor Ramon on the floor. Hebner then dives in front of the exposed turnbuckle when he sees it's been taken off and then goes to Michaels on the apron. Ramon gets thrown into the buckle. There's a side suplex for a two count by Diesel with Michaels constantly assisting Diesel. And very little resistance from Walter Payton. He was kind of very liberal in terms of the rules being enforced. Just, you know, he was there to watch. He wasn't going to get too physical. There's a big boot and a two count by Diesel as Ramon gets his foot on the rope. They went back and forth with abdominal stretches. Then there's a bulldog off the second turnbuckle for a near fall by Ramon. He then knocks Michaels off of the apron. There's a back elbow that Ramon runs into. And then Diesel goes for the jackknife. Ramon counters it with a back body drop. Michaels then grabs the title. And Walter Payton stops him from throwing it into the ring. And then while Earl Hebner is lecturing Walter Payton, Michaels runs into the ring. Diesel is holding Ramon. And Michaels goes for the super kick. Ramon gets out of the way. And Michaels takes out Diesel. Payton then pulls Michaels to the floor, and Ramon covers Diesel and pins him. 15 minutes and 3 seconds these two went, which, when you look at the level of workers Diesel and Razor Ramon were, especially at this time, that was a eternity.
Yeah.
And, hey, they totally had the crowd into this, and Razor Ramon wins the title, and then Diesel was upset at Michaels and followed him to the back as Ramon celebrated with Walter Payton and his son Jarrett, who was in the ring.
I thought this was a really good match. One of the best I can recall from either man's career. And, you know, sure, they might not be a workers on the level of Shawn, who, by the way, was excellent here. Just even doing
he was
thing,
great,
doing
I thought.
His thing on the outside. Like, just even being able to, like, kind of run through the ring and, like, kind of running in and out of the ring as quickly as he can in kind of his, like, very mischievous style, I think took a lot of talent, and he was able to do that really
and the
well.
Facial reaction when he hit Diesel, I mean, he was just great at playing that cocky prick at this point.
Yes, but as far as Nash and Hall go, I thought both men were working a lot faster than I ever remembered either man going, especially later on in their careers. Great timing in their spots too. Even that exposed turnbuckle I thought was used very effectively throughout the match. And even somebody like Walter Payton, for as little as he did, I thought his presence added to the atmosphere of the live crowd.
Yeah, so they told a very good story in this match. Crowd was completely behind it. Up next was Tatanka and Lex Luger. But first, we went to the back, and Randy Savage first acknowledged the crowd, congratulates Razor Ramon, and then sends it over to Vince for his second of three throws on the show. They replayed the super kick, which actually didn't look too great in slow motion. And they cut to these three fans at ringside who were decked out in like these white shirts with pink text on the shirts that read WWF and the F occupied by our man Vladimir.
Oh, no way.
Yes, making it to Chicago for this particular show.
On TNA and this episode.
He's just all over TV. You just got to look for him. Todd Pettengill's in the back in the with the locker room backdrop, my favorite, with Lex Luger and Tatanka. This was like a 1994 Jon Jones, Daniel Cormier, having these two face-to-face just moments before
call
they were going to go to battle.
Call him a pussy?
Okay. No, but I'm sure that's what Luger wanted to call Tatanka. And okay. Tatanka wants, you're just so fake.
Yeah.
And you're horrible at media.
I will literally kill you.
Literally kill you. With a tomahawk chop.
No, literally, not literally.
Literally. Literally. Literally. Literally. So we've got the long-awaited results of the SummerSlam opinion poll. 54% of the voters believe that Lex Luger has sold out. 46% think he has not. Tatanka says he has facts, and he shows all these video segments over the past few months with proof, he says, that Luger has sold out, including earlier today, Ted DiBiase going into Luger's dressing room with a bag.
Uh-oh.
With a bag. Which could have money. It could have drugs. Who knows? Tatanka's not going to say. He's not alleging anything. But he says he's sold out.
You know, I remember like watching as a kid having zero concept of what it meant when Tatanka said, you sold out. Like, the buzzword...
Did he run out of merchandise?
Like, the buzzword throughout this whole feud was, you sold out, you sold out. And I just remember being, like, 10 years old thinking, like, what does that mean? Like, are they, you know... I'd never heard that before in the playground. Isn't everybody doing this for money? Like, you sold out? Like, what does that even mean?
He's investing in his career here. This is a smart career path to join Ted DiBiase. Have someone, you know, like a sponsor.
I suppose so.
Yeah. So a real moral showdown here between Tatanka and Lex Luger. There was a mixed reaction for Luger. This crowd, they were believing. He sold out. And there was this super long wait for the bell to ring. And some incredible acting from one Lex Luger who says out loud, I didn't sell out. And the referee gets in between them before the bell rings, he gets in between them because they're shouting back and forth, and he breaks up the taunting in order to get the fight underway. You should see opposite. Back and forth at the start, there was a shoulder block by Luger, a mid-ring cross body from Tatanka. The fans boo Tatanka's war dance. He starts chopping Luger in the head, comes off the top. Luger gets out of the way. Ted DiBiase shows up at ringside. He has a bag as Luger starts his comeback. And then DiBiase is showing the money to Luger as he is distracted. And Tatanka rolls him up at 6 minutes and 2 seconds. The match portion sucked.
Yeah, not much of a match. Very basic stuff. And really just kind of a backdrop for the angle.
The angle was longer than the match. Luger was upset after the match. He gets into Tonka's face, and then Luger turns to DiBiase, kicks the money away, and then Tatanka attacks Luger, hits him with a Samoan drop, stomps him down, and then in a production snafu, they had the camera, the ringside camera, shoot from the mat, showing a close up of a $10 bill.
Oh, no.
So Tatanka apparently sold out for like an indie show payoff. And he hugs Ted DiBiase. The crowd is disgusted here. He continues this attack forever. They're going to leave. Ted DiBiase sends him back in. He applies the $1 million dream and then sticks a bill into the mouth of Lex Luger. So a big angle here and the heel turn of the Native American Tatanka.
Yeah. I don't remember the turn doing very much for Tatanka. I think he just like kind of became another guy right after this.
Really faded into kind of just the mid-card and then eventually gone. Mm-hmm. So didn't do wonders for his career.
The heel Native American, like, I don't know. Is that...
Didn't do it for you?
There's nothing that maniacal about that to me. Because we're Native American, or sorry, I don't even know if we're supposed to call them Native Americans.
No. I thought
it's
that...
Aboriginals, I think.
I don't know.
Whatever. I'm going to say Native American. That's how they describe Tatanka.
That's fine.
Native Americans are often portrayed as, you know, the ones who are being oppressed. And they didn't give me much of a reason to boo this guy.
So you were on the side of Tatanka here. You made a wise investment here.
Yeah, you should be compensated.
Gorilla Monsoon was in the back, still on the hotline. So he's holding his microphone and a phone to his ear.
Yes.
This looked very uncomfortable. And they are awaiting a guest. He calls Tatanka a disgrace to all Native Americans and says that Chief Jay Strongbow was pacing backstage watching Tatanka commit this heinous act as Luger's helped to the back. Mm-hmm. Gorilla Monsoon did not approve. How do you follow that? With Jeff Jarrett and Mabel.
Oops, there it is.
Oops, there it is. Mabel does the Jeff Jarrett strut early in this match after tossing Jarrett. There was an elbow drop to the back of Jarrett and then clotheslines him to the floor. Jarrett knocks down Oscar on the floor and trips Mabel in the ring. Jarrett hits some axe handles, can't take Mabel down. Finally, gets caught off the top, but then Jarrett hits him with an eye rake, applies his sleeper, and then gets him to one knee, and then Mabel backs him into the corner. This was so important, they then cut away to show Abe Knuckleball Schwartz in the crowd, still on strike. Mabel then holds him. Oscar slaps Jarrett, and then Mabel misses a splash off the second turnbuckle. Then he misses a sit-out splash, and Jarrett pins him 5 minutes, 55 seconds, and Mabel chases him to the back. I don't know why this was on the show.
Time fill, you know? That's really it.
What roster depth here?
Yeah, unfortunate. But, you know, for what it was, I thought they did a good job kind of making something out of this awkward size difference. I feel like anytime you have somebody wrestle Mabel, it's up in the air what you're going to get. But I thought Jared did a good job. It's got to be difficult, too, to work as a heel against a babyface who's like 3 times as big as you. But I thought they pulled it off here pretty, you know, decently.
Vince throws to Leslie Nielsen and George Kennedy, who are in the aisleway. And behind them is a silhouette of The Undertaker. But they don't turn around in time, and they miss him. Mm-hmm. The case was that close. Then that we get a whole history lesson on the feud with Bret and Owen Hart, going back to the Survivor Series from the past year, Owen beating Bret at WrestleMania. And as they're setting up the cage here, they go to Stu and Helen Hart at ringside. A bunch of the Hart family is all there in attendance. Helen says, "This is like a fever that has possessed Owen." Like he's under a spell.
My favorite female performer of the 90s, Helen Hart.
Helen.
She's just perfect.
It's horrible. And then still.
No, just the look on her face of like, she just looks so sad.
Oh, the cutaways during the match where she's putting her face in her hands. Yeah. And then Stu is just, you know, that was it. Lawler just chastises the entire family.
So funny.
Blames all of them and says.
This is just Lawler yelling at
them. Oh, he's just poor, like scolding them.
Poor little woman, you know.
Lawler was so great. Yeah. And says he only wants to speak to one member of the family, and that's the British Bulldog, because he beat Brett 2 years ago at this event. And says Bulldog says that Brett is in the best condition of his career. The family feud will end tonight, and he hopes that that is what happens tonight. And then, sitting behind everyone, looking like the emo kid in school, is Jim Neidhart, complete with sunglasses and the greatest outfit ever. These black and blue spandex pants with black bicycle shorts over top of them, like the epitome of the wrestler look from 20 years ago. Like, just give me a t-shirt that says fucking worker on it. And that is what Jim Neidhart looked like here. He says, and he's also wearing a SummerSlam t-shirt.
So they interview Jim Neidhart, who is obviously rooting for Owen. And then Vince notes, well, Bruce here might be the most volatile of them all here. And Bruce says Neidhart broke up the family, and he will not allow Jim Neidhart to get near that ring tonight. Mm-hmm. Not exactly a great prognostication from one Bruce.
No. Well, he was sitting in front of him. If he sat behind him, he would have seen him. But, you know, great. Anytime the Hart family is involved,
it's great.
I love it. I mean, just even think about the fact that, you know, if you're Vince McMahon, you have this family of wrestling performers to use for your storyline and to kind of set a great backdrop here. I thought having them around was great for this, obviously, this purpose.
Then we go to Todd Pettengill in the back with Bret Hart. And Bret is recovering from strep throat. And he says, when asked if it's going to affect him, he says it won't play any factor in the match. He says he will prove that he was always better than Owen. But he doesn't hate Owen. He doesn't hate him. He thinks Owen is jealous. When it comes to Jim Neidhart, he says, I might hate Neidhart because he started all of this. And he calls this cage barbaric. It never should have come to this. His parents and his family are begging for this to be the end. And he says, this will be the end. This was a great babyface promo, I thought.
I had to disagree.
Really?
I thought you recapped that very concisely and very well. But I thought this was not one of Bret's better promos. Just a lot of stuttering, a lot of what felt like rambling that was repetitive, repeating himself. It just felt like he didn't really know where he wanted to take it. And also just kept using the word heart as in, you know, it breaks my heart, along with the name Hart multiple times, so it felt very awkward.
Well, what's he supposed to say?
Well, maybe just simply a better choice of words rather than, you know, it breaks my heart, or you know, I'm going in there with a lot of heart as I take on my brother Owen Hart. You know, like, how confusing is that?
You should never refer to your brother by his first and last name together.
Well, he didn't do that, but it was just weird.
I like the promo quite a lot, actually.
And like I said last week, I thought Bret's a very underrated, you know, in that sense, because he can come across like very, very a very good, upstanding guy. And in this case, I thought he did a great job kind of just playing the brother who's reluctant to face his younger brother. In fact, like, I mean, I even like kind of made this connection you know, in recent years, but like George St. Pierre, when he talks to the media, he reminds me a lot about Bret the Hitman Hart, just in terms of like
my mother and my father, they say, is this the end?
But just what I mean is like he always champions sort of like the right thing to do, the right moral thing to do. And, you know, I thought he was great otherwise, but not so much here.
So we get the steel cage match, Bret and Owen Hart for the WWF title. Bret gives the glasses to Smith's baby, and then Smith reaches out to like high five Bret, and Bret leaves him hanging. Yeah. And Smith just tries to casually go from reaching his hand out to just waving to Bret. It was the most awkward brother to brother interaction you would see on this show. Anyway, match begins. Owen immediately attacks Bret as he enters, and they were great here having kind of Stu and Helen on a split screen at certain times. And I don't know if they were being cued, but my God, was Helen great here.
Oh, yeah.
Like, she was just – this was like she was watching an MMA fight between these two. This was completely real to her that her two sons are trying to kill each other in a cage.
Mm-hmm.
Owen hits this enziguri. They each take turns trying to exit, and I thought the near escapes throughout this particular match, this crowd got so into them.
Yeah.
And it was like just constantly doing a little bit more, trying to get over the cage, and the crowd every time just starting to shriek as they thought the escape was coming. And, man, they had to go 32 minutes here in a cage, so you get no near falls. You can't work in any of Bret's submissions. And let's not forget, in this time period, no blood either.
Mm-hmm.
So you're really handicapped in this kind of a match.
Yeah.
And many people regard this as one of the best cage matches the WWE has ever had. Crowd super hot here. Bulldog is standing up, cheering for Brett as he made a comeback, stopping Owen on the top. Bruce is up, warning Neidhart not to get near. Crowd just got insane as Brett comes over the top, but Owen brings him back, suplexes him, hits a pile driver. Owen is then fighting Brett off, slips and crotches himself on the top rope at one point, and they had this crazy fight back and forth by the door with the two just like mounting the other and just striking on top. Owen got catapulted into the cage. Then Brett is all disoriented from going into the cage that he crawls to the wrong side, which didn't have the door, and then finally finds it, and Owen just does this awesome leap like he was belly flopping into a swimming pool to stop Brett. The most amazing part of this match, this has to be the greatest match ever performed by a guy whose boot was untied. The whole match, Owen's right boot wasn't tied up, and I swear to God, if that was me, I could not concentrate until I tied my boot. It was driving me nuts watching this.
I didn't even notice.
And then the post-match, he'd lose the boot.
Wow.
It's crazy. They fought on the top. Brett kicked his arms off. Owen takes his back bump onto the ring. Then Owen climbs. Brett hits a big superplex off the cage. Great selling here as Brett, he's almost trying to do a sit-up and can't get up. Owen applies the sharpshooter. He's yelling he's going to break Brett's legs. And then Brett grabs Owen's leg and reverses it, which was the spot that they were about to do at Survivor Series with Shawn Michaels, the reversal. So they end up both on the outside of the cage. Owen's leg gets caught in the cage, and then he's hanging upside down as Brett jumps to the floor.
Brett now with Owen, and it's Owen.
Oh, wait a minute. Well, Owen,
look at that. And Brett runs out. Oh, no.
32 minutes, 22 seconds. Just incredible building of this over a 32-minute period, and this crowd was, I mean, they controlled this crowd. They were so hot for the finish.
These types of cage matches can be really boring and dull, but I thought both men just did a great job with their limitations. I mean, and also their style, it was just a brawl. There weren't so many wrestling moves, just a lot of punching. And whenever they had some free time or free space, they were going for the door or going for the climb. It was always kept very realistic in that sense. I think this match is just a great example of how you can create a really compelling match with only a small number of actual moves. Like, you contrast that with a lot of, you know, even cage matches that we see in today's kind of current style, where guys might just cram one high spot after another high spot. But then in a match like this, I think the magic of it is just what they do in between all the moves. It's all the squirming and then all the big tug of war that really takes place as they each try to escape that really makes this match effective and make it work.
Yeah, a great match. Afterwards, Jim Neidhart hops over the guardrail and clotheslines Bulldog from behind, who's standing in the front row, and not only knocks over Bulldog, but Diana takes the bump over the guardrail, and they land on a non-padded part of the floor. It was like cement these two landed on. And then attacks Brett on the floor. Neidhart and Owen take Brett into the ring, and Neidhart took approximately an hour to chain the door shut with a padlock, and then they beat down on Brett. Owen loses his boot, as I mentioned, and all the family members are coming out and trying to climb into the cage, and Neidhart and Owen are knocking them all off the cage until finally Bulldog gets in. As Owen and Neidhart retreat and leave, they use bolt cutters to open the door and tend to Brett, and Owen and Neidhart just flee to the back.
I love seeing all the hearts climbing the ring, but I have to say, Ross has got to be the slowest climber in the history of the world. I don't know if it was just Neidhart not paying attention to knock him off or what, but like basically all the hearts were climbing up the side of the ring, and then it was up to Neidhart and Owen to basically kind of pick him off one at a time. But then Ross, he was just ignored. So like Ross spent like a minute there just stuck on the side of the ring waiting for Jim Neidhart to pick him off. So he just came across like he was the worst climber in the world.
Well, Jim had a lot to keep track of, I think, between the post-match. Mm-hmm. Todd Pettengill is able to flag down Owen and Neidhart in the back. They state they don't want to talk about it, as they then proceed to talk about it. And Owen says they are not his family, and Bulldog should stay out of his business, and Owen is going to celebrate his victory. So the feud will continue.
Yeah, just some excellent, excellent pro wrestling storytelling with this entire saga. I just think of a fantastic match.
Yeah, a great, great match. I thought on par with their WrestleMania match, the much more famous match between the two from that year. They recap Yokozuna beating The Undertaker at the casket match and his death and promising a rebirth. And then we went to, goddamn, some of these stupid testimonials of Undertaker sightings around the country from deli owners, children, firemen, jewelers, and finally Ted DiBiase stating that he has made contact with The Undertaker, with Paul Bearer disputing this. Tons of vignettes. Eventually, DiBiase brings him, and Bearer finds his own Undertaker at the cemetery. And then on the final Superstars before SummerSlam, they had Paul Bearer's Undertaker do a voiceover in the arena challenging DiBiase's version to set up the match. And Ted DiBiase comes out for the main event, introduces his Undertaker, and then Paul Bearer brings out a casket with the Druids, and smoke comes out of the casket as it opens. He takes out this large urn, takes off the top of the urn, and this giant light comes out, and the Undertaker comes out from the back.
Reassembled.
All back together in one physical human being. And that would begin the main event between The Undertaker and The Undertaker. I will refer to this as gray and purple.
No, try to just say Undertaker.
Well,
Undertaker.
You couldn't even tell apart Owen Hart from someone's physical heart, so I think this would be even more confusing. The gray version walks towards Paul Bearer on the floor and gets grabbed by the hair, and all I'm going to say is that I think instead of there being one Undertaker impersonator, I would argue there were about 23,000 of them, because that's how many people were playing dead men during this fucking main event. I can't recall a main event with such little heat as this. Like, nothing. It was so eerily quiet that Vince McMahon had to call attention to it. Mm-hmm. There was nothing from this crowd. The gray version, he goes to drop. Fuck. I don't even know how to explain this. The purple one misses a clothesline, goes over the top to the floor. Just dead crowd here. The gray one hits a choke slam. The real one pops up, goes for a tombstone and hits it, but then rises up. He goes for another. The purple one reverses it, hits one tombstone, a second tombstone, and a third tombstone, and wins the match in 9 minutes and 10 seconds. The less said, the better. This was one of the worst WWF main events I can ever recall in history.
This definitely should not have main evented this show. It definitely should have been the cage match. You know, the problem with this, I thought, you know, they did a great job with the outfit. They did a great job with the look. And even not, you know, you have to congratulate somebody, Brian Lee here, doing a good job mimicking the zombie style of The Undertaker. But the problem is you have two guys working this same zombie-like style. And the end result is basically a match that is very slow, like a zombie fight. And you know, they could have done things, I felt, better, like perhaps the use of some gimmicks and weapons to kind of hide some of these limitations. And overall, I just feel like they didn't really put the babyface in much danger to make the crowd worry. And all of Brian Lee's offense really just consisted of like slow, low-impact moves, like these chops and smashing his opponent's head into the turnbuckle and things like that, that just did very little to build drama.
Horrible main event. The real Undertaker is alive. He puts the fake one into the casket, and it's taken to the back as DiBiase runs away to the back. And we finish with Randy Savage in the aisleway for his third sentence of the night as he throws to Leslie Nielsen and George Kennedy in the back, who open up the casket, revealing nothing. And then they see a briefcase in the distance. They go up, and George Kennedy notes the case is closed. Let's get something to eat. That was actually a replay of the heat spot during the main event.
That was a payoff.
That was it. Weeks and weeks and weeks of vignettes for a ha-ha moment. The case is closed.
Man, I wonder how much money they paid for that.
I don't know.
These things look like they cost money to shoot, you know? Some of these Domino's commercials and all that. So...
What a weird show. Like, some of the best and some of the worst of the WWF at this time. All on this one show.
Yeah. I feel like we'd have a much different opinion if that match and this angle didn't end the show. If it was Bret and Owen finishing the show, I think we'd look back at the show much more fondly. But the fact that, you know, it's Undertaker versus Undertaker all over the billboard and the VHS covers and all that, I think makes this show seem a bit more like a joke. But if you really look at it, break it down, there were some pretty good matches here. That Alundra Blaze and Nakano match was very good. Diesel versus Razor was surprisingly very good, I thought, for those two. And, of course, you have the classic Bret versus Owen match. So I'd still say this is a show worth watching simply for that. And if you want to laugh at the Taker versus Taker thing, it'll only cost you 10 minutes, so why not?
That's true. I mean, that was – they could have – stuck to their guns about, you know, an 18-20 minute main event to close the show, and thank God they had the foresight to know less still was terrible.
Less is less.
Yeah. So I give this show a 6 out of 10. Still a really incredible match with Bret and Owen, and as Wayne mentioned, there are certainly some positives to the show, but my God, that main event, I mean, you have to deduct when your main event is so poor as that was.
I have like kind of very nostalgic memories about this time. This was sort of like the period where I kind of became a big wrestling fan. So I give it 7.5, mainly for obviously that cage match and some of the other great matches that I mentioned.
We go to the feedback, and we start off with B. Cruz. I thought this was a pretty surprising show to start. It was weird to see Randy Savage reduced to hosting the show for only a few segments. The Alundra Blaze and Bull Nakano match was surprisingly awesome. Also really enjoyed Diesel versus Razor Ramon. I thought the addition of Walter Payton in Chicago was a nice touch. It was interesting to see that the WWF Championship did not main event the show. Was this always the case at this time? And how often did Hart main event pay-per-views? But anyways, fantastic match with an awesome finish that put both guys over, and the main event was fantastic. This is the build for all the ridiculous stuff that happened before the actual match. As off the match, it wasn't good. I'm sure you guys will have an interesting take on it. I give this show 9.99 out of 15. Out of 15.
Corey Ferreira. This show to me is all about the cage match, even though the big promotion was for Taker versus Taker. Bret and Owen was still the best thing going on in WWE TV. The cage match isn't a bloodbath or a spot fest like other cage matches are. It tells a great story of both men trying to escape the cage in a great sort of cat versus mouse story. A lot of people may find this boring because this isn't a bloodbath, but I think it tells a great story and ties in well to the brother versus brother angle. I also like all the Harts getting involved in the end, and it sets up both Davey Boy and Anvil's returns to the company further down the line.
Jeremy writes in from Texas. The build to this show is fantastic. Bret and Owen is one of my favorite feuds in WWF history, and it was clearly the match of the night. Razor, Diesel, Luger, Tatanka, and Taker all had great builds as well. I think part of it was the WWF only had 5 pay-per-views and less time on TV to progress these storylines. Maybe a case of less is more, something you'll never see around the WWE today. A little surprising Shawn Michaels wasn't booked to wrestle in some capacity. Was he battling some nagging injuries at the time, or was it mainly to progress his storyline with Diesel? Also, a bit surprising they took the tag titles off the Head Shrinkers heading into the show. It made that opening match very forgettable with something going on behind the scenes. Glad to see both guys in the 1995 SummerSlam main event were pinned on this show. I know WCW ended up running many shows out of the United Center, but I believe this was the only WWF show run out of the building. I'm guessing it's considerably less expensive to run shows out of the Allstate Arena in Rosemont, as it's usually one of the best crowds the WWE has all year. Maybe arena acoustics had something to do with that as well. Probably in the top 5 of all SummerSlams, considering the build to the matches, but didn't deliver as much in the ring. I'm glad the Million Dollar Man was carrying around $10 bills at the time. Probably picked the wrong close-up shot of money after the Luger-Tatanka match. I guess he had to cut back in 1994 as well. 7 cost-cutting measures out of 10.
We go to Aram, who says, my definitive all-time favorite cage match ever. I miss the blue cage, and if I'm not mistaken, they did a similar ending to the cage match at Rebellion 2001 with Edge and Christian. John, How does your wife accept all the wrestling and MMA you watch? Please give me some tips.
You just be a nice person all the time. That's just advice for life.
Simple as that.
Chris in Ottawa. There's never been a better match inside of Vince's ridiculous blue barred cage. In honor of the sheer number of mullets in wrestling during this era, can you please play the 94 classic Cut Your Hair by Pavement to close out the show? Another great song option will be Green Day doing When I Come Around live at Woodstock 94, where they played during a mud riot and had to be choppered out after their set abruptly ended due to anarchy and their gear getting covered in shit. Great feedback there.
Nick from Connecticut. Hey guys, I just joined the Law Pro Boards and I wanted to tell you how much I appreciate the many hours of episodes. They keep me entertained. I spend work as an MMA judge. I work as an MMA judge and spend many hours on the road going to and coming home afterwards. Well, that's nice. Going into SummerSlam 94, I was 13 at the time and had to wait until Blockbuster would have the event on rental. I did not have pay-per-view capability in my house until 99. The first match felt meaningless since the Head Shrinkers lost the belts the night before. Only thing I picked up during this match was when Vince translated off as gibberish as Domino's Delivers. Bull Nakano came up to the Orient Express's old theme song. I would love to see a bruiser like her come to the WWE now to beat up the Divas. I love the spot where HBK would sneak in front of Diesel when they posed during their entrance. Walter Payton was a pretty big celebrity to get here in Chicago. It's a shame he would pass away 4 years later. HBK was great doing the bumping outside of the ring in this match.
Matt from suburban Detroit. I remember SummerSlam for two reasons. Number one, it was the last pay-per-view we got for free, as weeks later the cable company my brother worked for closed down. Number two, the Naked Gun skits. They were awesome and are still fun to look back on and relive. As for the pay-per-view, it was solid. I was disappointed that there was no tag title match. I was a huge tag fan. I remember being overly invested in this Tatanka Lex Luger angle. My wrestling figures got a huge workout reenacting that turn. Even back then, I hoped Owen would have beaten Brett and had a rematch the next night on Raw, but it was the year of Brett. And the Undertaker match was just amazing, as I truly had no clue that there was a fake. I thought Undertaker had a twin brother. Overall, I give this pay-per-view 7.5 Vince McMahon commentatings out of 10. There's some feedback fueled by nostalgia.
Finally, Drew from Scotland, who says, amazing that with no WWE network in the UK, I was still able to find all these matches online apart from the six-man tag. Okay. Double J versus Mabel was fine with the big guy, small guy story. I think 20 years later, Double J is hanging with the Bullet Club. Very good women's match, started stiff and kept a slow, good pace that was fun to watch. Do you see Brie and Steph's match ending with the bridge German suplex? Nope. Crowd was super hot for the Diesel Razor match. I couldn't really remember the match, but was surprised how well it turned out. Brett and Owen stole the show. I'm sure you guys and other posters have mentioned that. Side note, I've heard you guys mention how the network might work in the UK, and I believe it'll be the same as Canada. Sky B have the rights, and you purchase Sky Sports from them at around £35/$55 Canadian a month, and you get Raw. From there, it makes sense that they'll create a WWE channel and charge X amount on top to subscribe. Pay-per-views here are £15, so anything under that just makes sense to purchase.
All right, thanks everyone for your feedback. Next week, we didn't know what to review, and Wade demanded we review this highly anticipated documentary that is now out. And what will that be?
That will be...
Did you forget?
No.
You don't know what it's called?
I know what it's called. I was going to make some joke. I was going to say whatever. We'll be reviewing the Paul Heyman documentary.
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Paul Heyman. The two-hour documentary next week, we're going to chat about and discuss all the many topics that come out of this. Have you seen this yet?
I have not seen it.
Okay.
I'm very much looking forward to it.
Well, I was smart because I watched it and I knew we'd review it at some point, so I jotted down notes.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of you have already seen it at this point. Feel free to contribute with your feedback. And if you haven't seen it, pick it up this week, watch it on the weekend, and leave your feedback before our review.
And I've got an idea to try and make this review very different next week.
Oh, what would that be?
I've got to do some digging. But next week, we might have a very interesting review, above and beyond our usual greatness of reviews.
Oh,
we're going to go a few steps deeper.
What the...
Oh, you're going to have to find out.
Paul Heyman will be joining us.
Maybe.
Maybe Gabe Sapolsky.
You never know, Wei. You never know. You'll have to tune in next week. I don't want to promise anything until I can deliver, like Domino's.
Okay.
So that's coming up next week, a DVD review of the Paul Heyman disc. And you can leave questions, comments on the Law message board, which where can people go? What is the Law message board, Wei?
Lawradio.proboards.com. And if you don't know how to type that in, go to Google. Google google.com.ca, whatever, and type in Law Radio Pro Boards.
But how much is it going to set me back to sign up for this thing you guys are always talking about on the podcast?
It'll set you back however much you pay for
it. Free 99. Yeah. Free.
Free 99? Yes. But, I mean, you got to pay for electricity.
Yes, but that comes with so much else in addition to us.
You got to pay for electricity, your internet bills. You got to fuel your body in order to be alive so that you can use our website, of course. So you got to pay for that.
Got to be hydrated.
Yeah.
Well rested. No carpal tunnel.
Imagine you got to pay for a shelter of some kind to enjoy.
Optional.
Optional, true. So it's actually quite expensive if you think about
in
it.
In the larger picture,
yeah,
nothing is free.
No.
But this is damn close to it.
Damn close to it.
So go sign up right now, lawradio.proboards.com. We will read your feedback within reason.
Not all of them.
Don't leave us a book.
Just make it good. And yes. Don't make it too long. If you, like, we're self-editing here. I mean,
challenge us. We'll go beyond
make it interesting.
This documentary was good.
Yeah, make it interesting. Give us some personal anecdotes. Yeah. I love it.
Write a song.
I love knowing how these certain shows are affected you maybe at the time that you originally watched them, or I don't know. Just make it different. Make it somewhat interesting.
That is the challenge that we are putting out to you, the listener. So we're going to get on out of here. If you're not familiar with all of our stuff, go to liveaudiowrestling.com. You can follow Wei on Twitter, Instagram, Tinder, at Wei0937.
Yes.
Right swipe him.
Within a 15-kilometer radius.
Yes. Come say hello to him. Mm-hmm. And you can follow myself just on Twitter, at I am John Pollock. And we are going to be back later this week. We've got Review and Impact. We've got Alex Greenfield filling in for Court Bauer this week on the show. And then...
What is the name of that?
I guess it'll be Greenfield and Pollock.
Oh, yeah. The king and the...
The... The king...
Oh, wait, sorry.
The king's...
So we came up with one, didn't we? Like, Grassfish or something.
What?
Greenfield.
Like, oh.
Lawnfish or something.
Greenfish. Greenfish. Fish that can't work.
Whatever.
That's coming up this week. All our usual shows. Of course, Sunday Night on the Law. Recap.
He had a good one. Like, he tweeted. Like, you should ask Greenfield.
What was the name of our show?
Yeah.
We'll find out. All right. You're watching SummerSlam on Sunday?
Yeah.
Oh, you are. Wow. That might change Sunday afternoon, but as of right now.
No, it's one of the big shows.
We always like when you come by.
I will.
It's always more
fun.
Well,
I didn't say I'd come by.
Oh, ouch.
I'm joking.
Why don't you just punch me?
So what's the deal with the network? Will I get it as a Rogers customer, or is it only like...
You have Rogers, right?
Yeah.
You have to... It'll be on the network this Sunday.
But I heard you and Meltzer say how it's only in select homes. Like, what
if you have Rogers right now, as long as you can access, like, it's on channel 512.
So it won't come with basic cable, obviously. But you have to have, like a VIP.
You do have to order the channel separately if you have Rogers.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I thought it was free, though.
I
thought it was a preview. You know what? This is all moot by this... The time this podcast airs, anyway.
I have asked actually Rogers. It's Monday right now.
Yeah,
and they've not gotten back to me yet regarding what. I can't imagine it's going to be a free preview for even a week, and you could watch SummerSlam for free. There's no way I could see that happen.
Okay.
No way. So just come watch it with us.
That's
the best option. The Law Network. Okay, we're going to get on out of here. Are we going out with that Pavement song?
Sure. Unless you have another suggestion.
Yeah, that's fine. We'll go out with that.
You don't have a fake Undertaker song?
I don't think so.
There's no song that just screams Undertaker versus Undertaker? John Pollock is Googling.
Let's go out with Ministry, the Undertaker theme from the WWF Aggression album.
All right. I kind of prefer hearing Pavement.
Okay, then we're going out with Pavement. Okay. Cut your hair. There we go. Goodbye.
Which Brian Lee probably had to do after this.
Yeah, I guess you could say this gimmick was kind of a DOA.
Darling, don't you go and cut your hair. Do you think it's gonna make him change?
I'm just a boy with a new haircut, and that's a pretty nice haircut. Torture like a puzzle, Pittman wearing muzzles. Hesitate to die, look around, around. The second drummer drowned, his telephone is down. Crazy band start up each and every day. I saw another one just the other day, a special new band. I don't remember lying, I don't remember lying, I don't remember a word, but I don't care, I care, I really don't care. Did you see the drummer's head?
Jay-Z and Beyonce might be getting divorced.
Oh, no.
Beyonce is said to be turning to family and God to help her through it.
Well, man, like when you're... I just don't think celebrity and marriage really go together.
There has been talk of divorce, and it's been really tense at times on the tour. Jay wants everything to work out, and it's trying to convince Beyonce how much he does not want a divorce. It's flowers, constant texts, and telling her he loves her. He is pulling out all the stops.
He must have cheated on her or something. Because, I mean, it sounds like they both actually don't want to get divorced, but there must be something that's so big that they just simply can't ignore it.